From the studios of EWTN, this is Open Line with today's host, Father Mitch Pacwa. In North America, call toll-free 1-833-288-EWTN. That's 1-833-288-3986. Outside North America, call 1-205-271-2985 or send an email to openline@ewtn.com.
Good afternoon to all of you. This is Father Mitch Pacwa Unleashed. There's no Jack Williams here to keep me minded, to be my handler and all the rest. So it's good to be with you all. And wherever Jack is, I hope that he's having a great time. Of course, we want to hear from you. Get your phone calls. Again, it's 1-833-288-EWTN, which is the same as 1-833-288-3986. If you're outside North America, you can still call in, but the number is area code or country code 1, area code 205-271-2985. All right, so let's take a look at some of the emails that you have sent in. Good afternoon, Father Mitch Pacwa. I understand that being in hell means total separation from God for eternity. My confusion arises since I thought that for our very existence, we need always to be connected to God. Is there a possibility that a soul ends up in hell would cease to exist? Are there any scriptural verses that shed some light on this? May be blessed. Mark from Pennsylvania. Well, first of all, Mark, it's our Lord Jesus himself who talks about hell being eternal. The flame doesn't go out and the worm doesn't die. Secondly, you are 100% right that God makes it possible for all of us to exist. And so it's not such a separation that the person's being is not supported by God. Everything that is exists because God keeps it in being. As my former sophomore high school teacher, the retired Archbishop of Kansas City, Kansas, once said in class, if God ceased to think about you for a fraction of a second — he didn't know about nanoseconds back seconds back then — but if God ceased to think about you for even a fraction of a second, you would disappear without even a puff of smoke. That was Archbishop Kelleher, James Kelleher, who said that in class. So yes, God keeps us in existence, but a person in hell is completely cut off from the love of God, and frankly, from the love of anybody else. Hell is characterized by eternal hatred and this, separation. C.S. Lewis has a wonderful book. I urge you to read it. It's an imaginative book about what it would be like to go from purgatory up to heaven. And he's a Protestant, so he sees this in terms of another chance. That's not exactly the way we see purgatory. But he talks about, the beautiful part of it is, he speaks of hell as a place where people so hate each other, they keep going farther and farther away from each other. And it's important to remember that the demons hate you. The people in hell hate you. You would hate them. And if they were your friends, you would blame each other for being there. It would not be anything pleasant. Okay? All right. Then, here's another one from Danielle. My mother and I had a disagreement about whether or not it is okay to burn frankincense in the home. Assume that it is blessed by a priest and burned reverently. My mother says that is wrong. Is it? No, Danielle. I don't see anything. I have a small chapel in my home, and I burned frankincense there because part of the celebrating the Maronite Liturgy of the Hours is during a prayer called the Hosoyo that we burn incense at the beginning of that prayer. It's followed by a prayer called the Etro. Etro means the aroma, because it's a prayer for the aroma of the incense. So there's nothing wrong with it. Not sacrilegious, nothing like that. Here's another interesting one. My husband is agnostic. One of the reasons is that he struggles with the idea that if Christianity were the one true faith, then why aren't the majority of people Christian? He claims that the majority of the world is atheist or agnostic. I've explained that people have free will, those who know, but do you have another explanation? Free will is the one part of the explanation. A second part of the explanation is that many people are not even allowed to hear about Christianity. For instance, in most Muslim countries, it is against the law to sell copies of the New Testament in stores. You can't have it in a bookstore. You can't, if you are a Christian and you go to visit Saudi Arabia, you are not allowed to bring a New Testament or a cross. So there is, and then of course in communist China, you have lots of difficulties. In communist North Korea, even worse, you know, bringing in a gospel. So it's very, very difficult in many places to even hear about the gospel. So this is something where Christians have to be more committed to allowing the Bible to be there and to evangelize people. But in fact, most people in the world are not agnostic or atheist. That's just, I don't know where he gets it. Now, in officially communist countries, they may claim that most people are atheists. But for instance, despite the limitations placed on people in China, there is still a growing number of people who are Christians, and the Catholic Church growing very well in China, despite official persecution. And it's important to note that communist countries use persecution and they prohibit getting information. Atheism is extraordinarily close-minded about faith in God and about knowledge of Christianity. So despite that, we still try to get it out there. And Christianity is growing in many Muslim countries, quite frankly. So this is a very important thing. So this is, I would question this major, about 2 out of 7 million people are Christians of different kinds. And then you have over a billion are Catholic, about 500 million are Orthodox, and then all the Protestant churches would be another 500 million or so. So this, maybe even more. So we're almost, we're certainly a third of the population of the world. And Islam is another billion. So believers are by far more numerous than non-believers. All right. And then, let's see, do we have 2 minutes? Okay. So Tom asks this, why don't we have any physical evidence of God? As an Old Testament expert, you know that God spoke to man over 2,000 times. I've never heard his voice. Why should we continue to be dutiful Catholics against this lack of evidence? By the way, God or no God, I really love your shows. That's very kind of you. And he also adds here, I don't want to even seem flippant. I'm struggling with my faith. Tom, first of all, physical evidence is not always the best evidence for everything. Physical evidence is good for various physical realities, but God is not a physical thing. And he's the one that makes possible all being. What I would recommend to you, Tom, because this is going to be another kind of evidence for you that if you take a look, there's a wonderful book that would, I think, really would help you learn how to think through questions about the existence of God versus physical things. It's called The Last Superstition, by which the author, Dr. Edward Fazer, means atheism is the last superstition. I would urge you to get Dr. Fazer, F-E-S-E-R, on that book, and he'll take you through the logic of why God's existence is very true. I don't have time for that all right now, because as you hear the music, it's time for me to get out of here and then be right back with your calls.
This is Open Line on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. If you have a question, call 1-833-288-EWTN. That's 1-833-288-3986. Outside North America, call 1-205-271-2985. Or send us an email to openline@ewtn.com.
All right, we are back and we have phone calls. We're going to start off with Paul in Saginaw, Michigan. Paul, what can we possibly do for you?
Yeah, Father, I called on Monday.
I wasn't here.
I know you weren't. And Jack told me that he was going to ask you for the very first question about it on Wednesday, but Jack isn't here today on Wednesday.
So there he goes. Promises.
Right. So I'm going to re-ask the question on Monday today to you.
Sure.
So here we go. In Revelation chapter 7, my question is, why is the tribe of Dan not listed with the other tribes in that chapter, as well as why is the girl Dinah or Dina the only girl in those tribes not listed? But Manasseh is listed, and I don't believe Manasseh was of the original 12 tribes. So what can you tell me?
Let me explain it to you. I always got some explaining to do. Couple things. Who was Manasseh?
I'm not sure now, but I know Manasseh was hooked with Ephraim. Wasn't Ephraim hooked up with Manasseh somehow?
Manasseh and Ephraim were brothers whose father was Joseph. They were born to him in Egypt. And Jacob blessed them both. Though he reversed the blessing, he put the blessing of the right hand, which is considered the stronger blessing, on Ephraim, and the lesser brother was Manasseh, even though Manasseh was first. So Jacob favored the second son over the older son, just as he was a favored second son over his older brother, slightly older brother, his twin. So that's one of the things going on. But Ephraim is not mentioned here either, is it? You don't see Ephraim.
No.
And Dina is not mentioned in any of the list of tribes because their system was patrilinear. So they always traced themselves through the fathers. That that had to do with inheritance law in the Bronze Age and in the Iron Age. They made exceptions when there were no sons, but apart from that, it was always patrilineal. So no place includes Dinah as one of the tribal founders. It's always the 12 brothers. That's the thing. But if you, Dan was a problem child.
Right.
They kind of they didn't really succeed very well. They were not able to defend themselves against the Philistines. They're originally supposed to be in the south, and they couldn't defend themselves against the Philistines. And they went up to the north, and they still didn't do well. So it's apparently because they didn't really survive. They mixed in with the various Canaanites who lived up in the north. So that was one of the reasons they were left out. And then Ephraim is left out, apparently because the Old Testament so frequently blames Ephraim. Ephraim was the territory where the city of Samaria was. So when they were doing something wrong, Ephraim was blamed for it. It was somewhat like when you were in trouble and your mother used your first and middle name. I don't know if your mom ever did that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yep. That was not a good thing.
Right.
As I, you know, I experienced. And it would be equivalent of that. So because he is so problematic, the name Ephraim is substituted with the name Joseph. Okay?
Now, did Manasseh's name replace Dan's name in the original 12 in chapter 7?
No, not in the original 12, but it replaced Levi, because Levi never got its own territory. The tribe of Levi was a priestly tribe, and they were not included among the division of land. But they are included here in this list. Now, this is, of course, just so other folks understand, this is a list of the 144,000 that are in heaven. And there are a couple things to keep in mind. What Paul is bringing out is that, A, these are 12 groups of 12 Israelite tribes.
Right.
And so, and I know that there are people from the Kingdom Hall of the Jehovah's Witnesses who claim that only the 144,000 will be in heaven, and everybody else will belong to a great crowd that is still on earth. Were you aware of that?
I've heard that before. Yes,
yeah,
I have.
Yeah. That's what they preach. And
I have friends that are Jehovah's.
Yeah. And the Jehovah's Witnesses are also, they claim that the last part of the 144,000 was closed off in 1935. So nobody baptized after 1935 would be eligible to go to heaven.
Wow.
Yeah, so you can't join. As far as they're concerned, nobody else can join the 144,000. And by the way, only the 144,000 can receive their annual communion. They have a communion service of bread and water that they pass around their congregation once a year in at Passover. But only the 144,000 can consume it. And since nobody is allowed, since who's been baptized after 1935, so they have that. That's one thing. The other thing, too, it says in chapter 14 and 15 that the 144,000 are all men, and they are all virgins.
Wow.
So the 144,000 is a fairly small group. None of the leaders or founders of the Jehovah's Witnesses would fit those categories because they were not of the tribes of Israel, nor were they virgin men. They were married. So right, that would be another right problem.
Anyway. A quick follow-up here real quick. Yeah. I've heard speculation that the reason why Dan was left out of those names of those 12 tribes mm-hmm was because there was speculation that maybe the false prophet or the Antichrist may be coming from the tribe of Dan. Is that true? Or what's the talk on that?
Never heard that. I don't know of any prophecy in the Bible that claims it. I don't know of anything in the Bible. If somebody has other evidence, let me know. But I have not heard any such evidence anywhere. So that's what we have. Well, Paul, I'm glad we got to your question. Let us now go over to Ryan in Midland in the Republic of Texas. Ryan, welcome back. What can we do for you this fine day?
Well, Father, I wanted to ask you, when a cause for sainthood is underway, mm-hmm, how does the church determine what a soon-to-be saint will be the patron or patroness of?
Sure. One of the things they do for the saints is relate the saint to various actions that saint was typically doing. So, patron saint of fishermen is obviously Saint Peter. Patron saint of carpenters would obviously be Saint Joseph. And the Blessed Acutus was so famous for using the internet to evangelize, he is now considered the patron. He's not canonized yet, but he's considered the patron of the internet because that's where he evangelized. And it goes on, Saint Hubert is the patron saint of hunters because he was converted while hunting, but then used his hunting skills to help convert the tribes of Saxons to Christianity. So it would be their kind of activities that they did that would help them to do that. Does that help?
Oh, yeah, it helps. The reason why I was asking is because last year I discovered Maximilian Kolbe is the patron saint of people who speak Esperanto, and I never knew him for speaking that language.
Yeah, you'd have to find out more about why. He's also the patron saint of drug addicts because he was killed by giving him a drug. So that I can see. You know, they after they had starved him for so many weeks, then they finally gave him a drug and killed him. So he's the patron saint of people who are drug addicts. They ought to have a shrine to him for that reason in the White House. They just found a whole bunch of cocaine in the White House this weekend. So this would be, we could probably use his patronage. But those would be... whether he ever learned Esperanto or not, I don't know. Certainly, he did a lot of international communication on his radio shows and radio station. And I don't know if he broadcast in Esperanto or not. That's a possibility. Esperanto is a fairly new language, so relatively new language. They need to find some sort of patron. All right. We'll take a break, come back in a couple of minutes because we have more of your calls, and you can still call into 1-833-288-EWTN.
This is Open Line on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. If you have a question, call 1-833-288-EWTN. That's 1-833-288-3986. Outside North America, call 1-205-271-2985. Or send us an email to openline@ewtn.com.
All right. Again, we have a couple lines open, so do call in. And we are ready to go over to Molly in Ontario. I take that it's Ontario, Canada.
Yes, it's Ontario. Hi, Father Paquette.
Hi. No, we have an Ontario in California, too.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, yeah.
I was wondering, so I've, like, been struggling with my understanding, like, of the papacy because of Eastern Orthodox objections. I'm not Orthodox, but I've been, like, reading their content. And
sure.
So did the Pope, like, in the first millennium, always exercise universal jurisdiction over the church? And was it kind of revolutionary, like, in 1014, I think that was the year, like, when he embraced the filioque?
1054. 1054,
okay.
Yeah. First of all, the 1054, the split was not the filioque, okay?
Okay.
There were other issues of jurisdiction. And, in fact, in the 1090s, they reconciled. I don't know if you knew that. The emperor of Constantinople, you know, worked things out with the Pope at the time, and asked the Pope to call for a crusade to help the Eastern Empire, because the East, you know, and again, a lot of people get this very confused. The reason they called the crusade was not to convert the Muslims. Did you know that?
I thought it was like to gain like treasures from the Holy Land.
No, no, no. It was because the Seljuk Turks had invaded the Eastern Roman Empire. And they were conquering city after city, and they were just across the straits of the Bosporus from Constantinople, so they needed help, and they worked out the problems. But then other issues came later. You know, it's one of these things. Now, when you say, does the Pope always use universal jurisdiction? No, you know, a lot of times his jurisdiction is local. You know, he rules for things in Rome and in Italy. But other times, he does rule universally. And that's gone on from the early church. So the Pope has had that kind of authority early on. Didn't use it very often. But, you know, sometimes if... I don't know if you can find this book. It's on the papacy, and it's quotations from the Eastern Church and Eastern Church fathers. Lots and lots of these. I tell you what, I'll have to look it up. I think I've got it in my files here, so I may have to look that up. But it's the kind of thing that let me just take a quick look here in my files. That there are lots and lots of quotations from the early church on you know, the role of the popes. And let's see, that's not it. I'd have to look around, sorry. So this is a very important point, that it was recognized. But again, it was used rarely. Just like infallibility is used very, very rarely. We don't have much use of papal infallibility. And in fact, you know, even when the Pope personally calls a council, most of the time he does not even go to the sessions so that he makes sure that everybody gets a chance to speak. That's part of the history. So, he has final say, but, you know, he doesn't use it a whole lot. Does that help?
Yeah, so, like, you said there were, like, Eastern fathers and stuff who did believe in, like, the jurisdiction of the Pope, and it's, like,
right.
The Eastern Orthodox are, like, wrong when they say that, like, the Pope doesn't have universal jurisdiction.
I would say that that would be incorrect, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, and, yeah. You know, and it's, you know, one of those things that I don't, you know, I very much want to see, you know, here it is. I found it. I had it hidden in another place. It's called Jesus, Peter, and the Keys. That's the name of the book. It's been so many years since I've seen the author. Jesus, Peter, and the Keys is the name of the book. And actually, the same author has Scott Butler. That's it. Boy, it's been a lot of years since I've thought of his name. Scott Butler. And he has been doing more research, with, you know, Eastern, primarily focusing on the Eastern resources. And he's getting that material out there. So that would be a good source to go to. Does that help?
Yes, thank you so much, Father.
You're welcome. Let us now go to Maria, who is in Ashtabula, Ohio. What can we do for you?
Hello, Father Mitch. How are you?
I'm just fine as frog hair. Have you ever seen frog hair?
No.
That's how fine I am.
My sight's very limited.
So what can we do?
I've heard you say on EWTN radio, you know, this clip that they play in between shows, something about the people that go to mass live about 5 years longer than the ones that don't.
Yeah, this is
us. How does that work for the homebound listening to EWTN?
Here's one of the things. A lot of the people who don't go to church are also, that includes primarily, the majority of them would be the people who don't, A, have much faith in God, pretty limited faith, and B, have a fairly limited commitment to God's commandments. And they oftentimes are engaged in a wide variety of behaviors that shorten their life. Sin, and again, you have to be careful about this, because I was just basing this on studies that have been done for the last, since the 70s, so the last 50 years practically, and they consistently show that people who go to church live longer, about 5 years longer on the average, have fewer heart attacks, have better marital lives, etc. And all those things interact. But when somebody is homebound, you know, but still practicing their faith, you know, a lot of homebound people will watch church on television or listen on radio, and they pray along because they have faith, and they live the commandments within the say, if they are disabled, they live the commandments within the limits of their disability. So they may not be going out to bars to get drunk, but they don't get drunk at home either. They're being faithful. Whereas drunkenness is definitely one of the behaviors that a lot of church goers do that can keep them with a shorter life. That's a dangerous activity to get drunk. A lot of people who are not church going might also be those who are living with lots of sexual immorality, or maybe using drugs. And those activities shorten your life. So it was a shorthand way for the researchers to notice that people who go to church live longer. They were, you know, asking a simple question. And the homebound people, you know, would be, again, they might be filled with religious fervor and faith. And that's going to help them find meaning in their suffering. Whereas people who don't have faith and don't go to church cannot find meaning in their good health. And they oftentimes do things that are foolish. So yeah, there's a variety of things that'll be variations and variables in such a study. And you have to pay attention to those. But the study is something, and again, it's been repeated over and over again, and it's a consistent result that people go to church, live longer. Does that help?
So I guess then it will help me since I listen to EWTN all day.
Well, see, that's going to be something that if you're listening in faith, if you're sitting there getting mad at Packwell because he's an idiot, that may not help you too much. But if you're praying and, you know, enjoying the masses and the other prayers and learning about your faith, then, yeah, of course it's going to help you. All right?
All righty, thanks.
You're welcome. Thanks for calling. Let's now go to Francis in Richmond, Virginia. Richmond. Francis, what can we do for you?
Well, Father, years ago, I remember, I thought you talked about a martyr, and I'm sorry I don't remember his name, but ooh, I think you said he was the most tormented martyr in history. He really got beat up badly. Could you recollect who that might be?
Yes, I can. It's Saint Andrew Bobula. Probably you haven't heard much about him. He was a Polish Jesuit in the middle of the 17th century, right around 1640s. And he was martyred by Cossacks in, I think, Lithuania or Belarus. And the reason we know about his torments is that he's incorrupt. His body didn't corrupt. And you can still see his body. It's in the Jesuit Church of St. Andrew Bobula in Warsaw, Poland. It's in a glass coffin. So you can see his body. And it was horribly tortured. I've been there to see that once. So, when he was being examined for canonization in the 1930s, took that long because his body was in Russia, and they finally were able to bring him out in the 1930s. And when they brought it to Rome, there the office that takes care for canonizations said that this was the most tortured saint in the history of the church. That's where I got that from. It wasn't my personal opinion. It was theirs. Does that help?
Sure. Yes, Father. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. He's also a co-patron of Poland. He was made one of the co-patrons. All right. Let us now go to Marie, who is north of San Francisco, California.
Good afternoon. Thank you. And I love listening to you, Father Mitch Falkla. Thank you.
Oh, my pleasure.
How does a practicing Catholic find an element of truth in family members that are practicing Reiki, yoga, shamanism, New Age stuff? What is one element of commonality from which to build from? And secondly, what is their I know this is a broad question, but what is their kind of overall thing? Is it basically about I am God and I can heal myself? Hmm. And
first of all, keep this very clearly in mind, Marie. Do the people who originally, do you know where shamanism came from?
I don't know if I want to know.
Oh, why wouldn't you? It's not bad to know. It's good to know. It's from Siberia. It's a Siberian word, native Siberian word. And Reiki is from Japan. A Japanese Christian applied, but he had sort of gone into a Taoist approach, and he used the Japanese word. You've heard of in Taoism, they talk about the qi energy.
Yes.
And in Japanese, it's ki. That's just a different word. It's the same word, but just in Japanese. And he came up with the Reiki on his own. This was his invention. Yeah, this is not anything ancient. Why? Here's my question to you. Why would you think that there might be something that holds them together?
Not necessarily holding them together. It's just a broad question of just so that I kind of understand what is their... Maybe it was incorrect to kind of make a broad statement against all of them.
But
is there fundamental theology that...
No.
You know...
No.
Of I am God and I am creator and I am the wind and I am the earth and I can do whatever.
No, that would not be the belief of Reiki or shamanism. Shamans would never say that. And see, this is where what you have and you know, it's not unusual in Marin County. It's kind of famous for some of this in other parts of California of trying to subsume this variety of religious expressions into a New Age mentality. In the New Age movement, they believe that they are God. And they try to take these other practices, and it's much more of... I sort of joked around years ago, but I still don't disagree with it as I look back. It's a Mr. Potato Head approach to their theology. They take a little bit of a little bit of the shamanism, a little bit of Reiki, and this mix and match all these little parts as if they are interchangeable. And the problem with that is it's just the same thing that happens with Native American religions and Native Canadian religions. Each Native people was its own culture. There was not one vast Indian culture. Not at all. The Navajos have a different culture and religion than the Hopi, or than the Apache, or the Cheyenne. They're all this, and to try to sort of melt them all together is like trying to melt all the Crayolas in your box into one new color. It just ends up a gray mess. And each one of those is distinct and has its own characteristics. And there's the New Age folks tend to be fairly... I consider them to be fairly disrespectful to the uniqueness of each of those religions and the cultures from which they came and the cultures which they formed. And you have to study them on their own, for their own merits. Does that make sense?
It does. I guess, what is the Catholic position on these, and what is the commonality that is in tandem with Catholicism, so that they have some basis of... You know, how to build a bridge.
Yeah, you build the bridge by understanding each one of those religions on its own terms. And then you compare that to the gospel. There is no one way to say, oh, all these religions are like this in Catholicism. They each have such different perspectives on God. You know, not all Native Americans believed in a happy hunting ground where they would spend eternity hunting in a paradise where there's plenty of game to hunt. That was the conception of some groups, but not others. And I dare say a lot of the New Agers would not want anything to do with a happy hunting ground, would they? They probably don't want to hunt any animals. And you have to pay attention and try to deal with each specific religion and see what is connected with Christian faith and what isn't. You can't have a one concept that holds it all together. That doesn't exist. And so it's a lot of work. And this is where ecumenism shows respect for other religions by taking them very seriously. But we also take the gospel of Jesus Christ. And we as Catholics start off with what Christ has revealed about God and about being human. And we begin there and we dialogue and let people know this is the distinctive element of what God said to us when he became man. See, most of these other religions would never conceive of God becoming a man. You know, that would not be, and dying for us, that would not be part of what they look to. So you have to enter into that dialogue with respect. Does that help?
It does. Thank you for your time.
Absolutely. All right, let's go to Carolyn in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, the former home of the Houma tribe of Native Americans.
Hey, bonjour.
Bonjour. Comment ça va?
Yeah. You know, in the memorare prayer, despise not my petition. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine Mary despising, she could despise the devil, that's the only thing. But,
yeah.
You know, it could say ignore not my petition, but mm-hmm. what would they meaning by the word despise at that time? Or?
Yeah, well, no, it's not a matter of it at that time. This is a way to say exactly what you're saying. Our Lady would never despise one of our questions. She just wouldn't. I don't even think she bothers to hate Satan. She just doesn't go there. You know, the hatred is not part of her. But you say that out of a certain type of profound humility. I know that what I'm asking for, I don't deserve. But it would be the kind of language of a royal court, which is what you're doing. You're presenting your petition in the royal court of heaven, and with an exaggerated kind of humility, say, "Don't despise my petitions, but hear and answer me." And I know I don't deserve it, but that's what I need you to answer me. That's where that comes from. It's more of a literary device than a theological statement about Our Lady. Yeah. Okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Let us now go to Andrea in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. How are you, Andrea?
I'm good, Father. Well, actually, I'm a little worried about the psychology of narcissism, and I've been hearing about it on a podcast. Mm-hmm.
Good.
And it seems so invasive.
It is. Psychologists call it a pandemic, a psychological pandemic.
Yes.
So,
what I was wondering is about what we can do. My grandchildren are dating age, and I'm.
Do they trust you?
Experiencing terror. Yes.
Yeah, they trust. Okay. But here's what I would do. Have a discussion with them. Here is what a narcissist looks like. And narcissists usually don't get over the narcissism until they're in their 60s, because it takes them that long to figure out the world does not center on them. So be careful about, not dating them. Here's what you look for. in a narcissist. And share with them some of the information from the podcast and from other sources. That'll be a very useful thing because narcissists are not good fixer-uppers. All right. Lord bless you all and keep you, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen.